Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Nothing more positive on a summer day than we're going to have in this next segment, but I want to give a shout. I've talked so much about the Harka ice cream and the Honey Graham. The pistachio has caught me here this summer. It's probably because Don Mohler and I can't sit at Orga Park at Camden Yards and eat pistachios anymore, or Ravens games at this point. This is chock full of ground roasted pistachios. Don, it's almost as good as sitting at the ballpark, but it's actually better because it's summer and it's cold and it's delicious. So
you know,
sure.
I never
pistachio yet or no?
I never interrupt your riff on our sponsors, but I will tell you that I had someone, and I bet our guest when we get to his head to Harker, I had somebody text me last night and said, all right, where do I find this ice cream,
online,
guys?
You online. Got
me. So I told him, I said, it can't Click. Be any easier. Go online, order a case, get all the flavors. They'll bring it right to your front door.
Fadley's is probably where we would be having this next guest, and probably a big fat crab cake, maybe some oysters. I would have a beverage of choice as well down at Lexington Market. Fadley's will ship those crab cakes everywhere in the world, and even though we're not there since COVID and we're not over at State Fair, I was at State Fair last week actually having the chicken and waffles and some raspberry sauce in the morning when we were named Best Baltimore Conversation. And I want to give a shout out to Mohler and Gary Realty, and I want to give a shout out to KO for helping us out along the way. But this next person that we, Don, there's still people from the first list. Jane Miller was in my top 10 of people we wanted to have on. We'll get her on before this, and then after this, and then this, and we'll have her for crab cakes, then we'll have her for chicken. And here we are, finally, a year and a half
later. Finally.
How did we get to be Baltimore's best conversation without ever having you on?
I don't know. It was a fluke.
We were going to do this way back, like months ago, right?
We were going to do it around the election, remember? It was around the original April 28th election,
yes, correct.
Right.
That's right.
Jane knows my story, and I'm sticking to it. Jane and I have known each other. We're at least I'm old. I don't know. Jane stays the same, but we've been at this.
I'm not. That's correct.
We've been at this a long time. And Nestor, you've heard me say, the funniest thing, and they were always the same words. I said the most dreaded words in my jobs was my assistant or someone else, one of the other folks that worked for me, would come in and they would go, "Hey, Don, Jane's on the phone," and it would be like, oh, God.
It's like with 60 Minutes calls,
no,
right?
Man, it would be like,
right, there you go.
Jane's on the phone. I didn't think she was calling to ask me to go play golf. So, but, Jane, you've been at this. Welcome to Baltimore Positive. Great to have
Thanks
you.
Thanks for
you,
having me, both you, of you, really.
You've been at this a long time. I just want to jump in. I mean, it's amazing. You've been at BAL 35. You've been at
more.
The 34?
No,
more than 35?
Yeah. 37.
37. You've
right.
been at this thing almost 50. Talk about how the news business has changed from when Jane Miller, this young gal from Penn State, jumped out and had that first microphone in her hand. How's it changed over those years, Jane?
Well, the technology has certainly changed. And here we are again in a change in technology forced by, you know, a pandemic. Just the way we're talking right now, which is, you know, through a vehicle that's completely online. I don't have a camera here. My camera's in the computer. I don't have a camera person here. We're conducting a lot of business this way right now. But certainly, I mean, when I started in television way back in 1976, it was film. I mean, the microwave was the next generation, and that came online shortly after that, started to come online.
When could you go live? Could you have gone live in 76 from one location, maybe? Because when happened, that probably live local late breaking, right? Changed
yeah,
everything, right?
It did. Some stations were ahead than others. I didn't start at WBAL, and WBAL was kind of ahead of that game. But I think the first time we could actually do something live, I was working for WQED Pittsburgh in 1979. When Three Mile Island occurred, the nuclear accident. And I remember doing live broadcasting there, but it was a huge production to get cameras into the field to be able to do that kind
crazy
of
crazy expensive
wired.
To get
oh,
five
yeah.
minutes,
there wasn't
right? yeah.
wireless microwave was not widely available. So
this is amazing. Like, I, you know,
it is.
I've
I know,
been doing
it has
this
really changed. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I started the News American in 84 with hot
right,
metal pipe,
go.
Right? Like,
right.
literally, we had to, like, put it in trucks and deliver it in black and white. I mean, it's just
right.
it's a whole different
yeah.
world.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. But the basic premise of what we do which is to cover local news, to cover your own backyard, hasn't changed. It's the same. It's just that our technology has changed, and our the means with which we get information, the amount of information that's available.
We
through,
love live.
You know,
live's
the
great.
Internet research, all that is just way more, you know, I mean, it makes it easier in some ways, but it's still the basic of what we do has not changed.
Well, Jane, I want you to, and I'm going to come back in a little while. It's funny you mentioned 3 Mile, because on my notes, I have circled 3 Mile Island.
Huge,
I don't know that I've
challenge.
Ever talked to anyone
yeah,
that covered
really
it. I don't want to lose it. I'm going to come back to it. Mm-hmm. But before I jump to that, what were the guiding, I mean, principles? I've always said to folks, and it was one of the reasons why all of my bosses, you know, they never ran from you across mm-hmm. the street. I say, I've always, as you know, you and I have chuckled from time to time about the silliest thing anyone can ever do when Jane Miller is standing there with the camera is run and jump in the car and try
take off.
Jane, yeah, take off. It's like Jane's, it's like Christmas Day for Jane, right? Oh, this is a great shot. I've got people. So
we got a runner.
I can remember. I can remember saying to Kevin particularly, I said, well, Jane's out front. He said, okay, let me comb my hair and let's go on out. And, you know, and I think, you know, that respect for you and what you were doing and knowing, I mean, listen, full disclosure, you and I think are friends, but there have been times when you and I weren't happy with one another.
Correct.
There
sure.
Certainly times when you lit me up. And times when you're laughing, and times when I
see, I won't feel so bad when I light him up.
Oh, no. There right. were a few times where I had to hold the phone out here when Jane was not happy. But we always got to a place of mutual respect. And I guess there are a couple questions there. How did the press become the enemy of the people, Jane? I mean, that's
really, Don, that's like 3-hour conversation, I think.
Well, we'll have you back.
Well, I'll tell you, what you just mentioned is really important. And that is a guiding principle of mine forever has been to be fair. And somewhere along the line, what really concerns me about journalism is the concept of fairness has been compromised. And I mean, you see this, like, so if you're not reporting what someone wants to hear, you're the enemy. If you're reporting, you know, I mean, I get, social media is probably the number one, you know, accelerant on this fire, because it gives everybody a platform with which to criticize, try to discredit you, you know, argue, whatever, without, you know, necessarily any kind of evidence-based argument.
Right.
COVID is teaching us this every day. Oh my God, we are up against it in trying to present information that is science-based and, you know, kind of best practices, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, people just don't want to hear it. But I think that along the way, there's been erosion of this principle of, you know, telling two sides of a story and being fair. Some of that has been, I will be honest, I think some of that has been this particular president has really had an impact on that. Because this particular president, Trump, has, if you look at it, has kind of given license to many things that are not terribly part of a civil discourse. And the media, he has declared the mainstream media as an enemy. So you do have that, and that's there's just no getting around that. That has happened more so than, and most presidents don't like the media at one time or another. Most people in elected office, but this has been an absolute campaign of his to try to discredit news organizations, the New York Times, CNN, you know, even sometimes local news as well, and. So I think
Well, you could say to Fox and Ailes and Murdoch were part of that too. I mean, this is the result of this, right?
Rush Limbaugh. I mean, you go back to this kind of it's somewhere along the line the practice of kind of ranting, using a broadcast medium for ranting, became kind of the culture of the country. And it's just kind of gone from there. And so now here we are today in 2020, and we have a polarized country on every count. This country doesn't agree on anything. There is no middle ground. Friends of mine and I've for a couple of years have been talking about, can the center hold? That's a good question.
Well, Jane, yeah,
I'm not sure where the center is.
I've heard about Russian disinformation my whole life. And in my own circle of the world, from East Baltimore through my journey and at newspapers and my journey through sports and sports journalism and, you know, meeting people in baseball and football and basketball and all sorts of walks of life, it is fascinating that the journalism and the newspaper kid in me, the kid that read the newspaper in the 1970s, wanting to be a news reporter and a journalist and had been since I was almost 15 years old, was really about trying to get the truth and trying to get the facts. I'm not sure it's presented as such anymore, right?
Like That's what I mean, right.
Where the Kellyanne Conways, you know, come in with this alternative fact or whatever. And I saw this great quote from Carl Sagan in a book that, you know, he wrote 30 years ago about there will come a time in America where we can't delineate between what's true and what makes us feel good, right? And and there somewhere in between there, I think, is a problem. And Don, you talk so much about trust in news media. We're talking to Jane Miller, by the way. Jane, you've made a 40-year career, for better or worse, even being angry at Don, and I can't wait to ask you what he pissed you off about.
We probably can't remember.
I made a career.
That's exactly right.
Well, a career on being honest and telling the truth, right? And what is a fact? And these are the same ideals we hold our family members to, the people we choose to love, the people we choose to have around us, the way we choose to worship, and all of that is, are you being honest with me, right? And I have a feeling that when Don held the thing out there, you felt like there was some tinge of, hey, you didn't tell me the whole truth, nothing but the truth. For all of us now, the truth used to be what the encyclopedia said or what the newspaper said or what the nice lady on television said back in the 80s when I was a young boy. But I think where we get our truth now is really, that's what's screwing us up. And that's what journalism and education and science and all of those things were supposed to be there for.
Well Jane, I want to piggyback on that, because every time we have a reporter on here, either broadcast or print, I give them my premise. And then I want to ask you to see if I'm accurate or I want you to correct it. And when folks say to me, and I've had it happen just the past few days with some cousins who say, it's just all, you know, the media, you guys, the media just hates the, you know, hates Democrat. I mean, hates Republicans. You guys slant everything. And I always say to folks, guys, I've dealt with the media for 30 some years. Here's my takeaway. If they have a bias at all, it's not about the party, it's not about Democrat. Their bias is they believe that people in power tend to try to protect that power and don't always tell the truth. And their job is to try to expose the truth. It's not about D's and R's. Their bias is they don't think people in power are always forthcoming. That's my premise, right or wrong, or correct me.
Well, I think, look, when I teach classes, et cetera, I always tell students, look, organizations, politicians, each of us individually, we all have the same human instinct, and that is to protect our own interest. So I particularly, right, you know, now policing is a big deal, and the police practices and community relations, all of that. And For years, I have said to, you know, young reporters, et cetera, when a police organization spokesperson tells you something, remember, that's in their best interest. They may not tell you the whole story. They probably won't tell you the whole story. And your job is really to try to get to a more complete story. It's about truth. What is truth? But a more complete story, a more complete picture of what may have happened, and not to rely solely on somebody's word for it. I don't necessarily think that most elected officials are trying to hide something at all. They're acting in their best interest. And their best interest means they need to get reelected if they're going to run again. And they need to present, they need to have a, you know, kind of a clean reputation, et cetera, without any, you know, any controversy. I mean, what elected official wants controversy? Nobody wants controversy. So I think that's what it really is that it's just, you know, organizations and corporations and elected officials, et cetera, they act in their own interest and they protect their own interest. And, you know, some in rare occasions, that has really gotten people into some very serious trouble. Right. But always by and large,
by and large,
it's not that. It's just, you know, trying to protect their interests.
Well, that's, you know, that's my, Nestor's heard me say it over and over, Jane. I always talk about the whiteboard in my office. It was tell it all, tell it first, tell it yourself. It rarely
get ahead of it. Right.
Credit to Lanny Davis. You know, it's not a Don Mollerism. It's a Lanny Davisism, but it's on every whiteboard I ever had in my office. It rarely turns out well when you're trying to shade the facts or delay. Just go out there, talk to the people, and be honest. Get out of it. If you're just tuning in, we are with award-winning broadcaster, investigative reporter, WBAL-TV, Jane Miller. Jane, you alluded to, we've got a lot to talk about. I want to talk about Baltimore and the city and how you're so involved. You're not just a reporter.
We should really talk about that now.
Are you going to take me off of journalism? Because I had a journalism question.
Well, go ahead. You do journalism. But I want to say, people who know Jane, not only she is a reporter, she's one of the most invested citizens in Baltimore, which is,
I think,
what her heart comes through in her reporting. So before we go to Baltimore and Three Mile Island, and we may have to have Jane back because I know we're going to run out of time after we do all this. But Nestor, go with your journalism question.
Well, just the investigative part, because he called you investigative journalist. And I guess it goes back to my previous statement, which is when Jane reports it, it's true. Well, how do we know that? Well, she hadn't lied to me in 30, however many years you've been,
really
right?
Important.
So,
right.
So, you know, and I like to stand on that for 30 years of radio and being thrown out of the Orioles 15 years ago because they didn't want me asking them questions. So, you know, for you on the inside of this in investigative journalism, and we've talked so much with you know, Joan Jacobson recently and all sorts of Sun reporters and Save Our Sun and Where We Are, Dixon, Pugh, Wayne Jenkins, all those things happened under your watch, as well as other corruption, not going back maybe to Agnew, but just after that. But
close,
in the modern times and investigative, someone gives Jane Miller a tip, you know, Dixon's got 30 gift cards, or that Kathy Pugh's built a house Holly, or hey, there's a cop that's like stealing guns and mugging everybody and putting $100,000 and killing people. All of these crazy stories that I would think, you know, much like when I'm in sports journalism, people call and say they saw Deion Sanders at the airport or whatever it was that was going to stir something up, right? But when you get those type of things at this point, the amount of work that goes into busting Catherine Pugh or Wayne Jenkins is literally the same amount of work it takes the FBI to bust them, right?
Oh, in some cases, more. We don't have the advantage of a wiretap. Key to the kingdom in the Gun Trace Task Force case. It does take a lot of work. And there were many elements. You know, the Catherine Pugh case really boiled down to a campaign finance case. That's really what it is. And then tax evasion. I mean, she was using a business entity to collect money and then use it for purposes to fund her campaign and to pay her for her house. I mean, that's what she did.
We might be hearing about that from a guy at Pennsylvania Avenue at some point.
Jane, I'm assuming, I like Nestor's question, because one of the things we do try to do is to pull the curtain back and let folks get a sense of how things work. I would imagine that by the time Jane Miller gets her 60 seconds or on a big, big night, 90 seconds to tell her story, if it's a big story, there are hours and hours of Jane Miller just beating the pavement that people don't see. Give our listeners a sense of how that evolves.
Oh, it evolves in many different ways. So I did a longer piece in right before coronavirus kind of took over our lives. I did a piece which was trying to illustrate the racial wealth gap. And it looked at two communities which everybody is familiar with in the Baltimore area, Edmondson Village and Rogers Forge. And the reason I chose those two was because They were both built by the same builder, which is still in business today. And there also each community had applied for national historic status, and that meant there was a lot of information available for property. So this involved looking at values of property.
Now these were built late 40s, early 50s, kind of sort of?
1940s, correct. Two-story brick row homes, they're exactly the same kind of house.
Is that Jim Keelty?
Yes.
Yeah, it that's is. What I thought. You're right, Jim Keelty.
Correct. And at any rate, to make a long story short, because the piece was pretty lengthy, I took months to do this because it involved title searching, which I happened to grew up when working for my dad's law firm, learned how to search a title. So I know how to do it. But the transactions that occurred in Edmondson Village because of blockbusting were so complex to sort them out and to figure out exactly what happened. It took a long time. I would spend hours on a single property to figure out everybody that had their hands on that property. I spent hours and hours and hours in the Baltimore City Land Records office going through the old block books, because there's a particular investment vehicle called the land installment contract that's not necessarily recorded the way that other things get recorded. So you had to kind of find them. And I bring this up because I've often said that news gathering is a lost art. And I think that there are too many in journalism, too many people in media, et cetera, that rely on, comments on a social media page, stuff that circulates on social media. Not that that's not a source of information. It is. But generally, if you're seeing something on a social media post, it's probably not a full story. And it probably needs further review and investigation. And I think that the art of really digging around, the same thing, some of the stories I did during the Catherine Pugh case, it involved a lot of land record searches. It involved going through I had to make spreadsheets of her campaign finance contributions to be able to see where the suspicion was, and then had to knock on doors. I was knocking on doors in Little Italy, getting some pretty interesting stories.
Well, good criminals aren't that sloppy, right?
No. Well, I wouldn't say sloppy, but, it's these days, it is very hard to hide a trail. It's very hard to hide a trail. I mean, there's, electronic trail of everything.
Yeah, the days of bags of money have gone away, right?
But the point being, when I listen to you talk, the point being that the viewer of BAL, it's six live, local, and late breaking, thinks that Jane just pops up there and says, "Today, Catherine Pugh, boom, boom, boom." Jane just ripped that off the wire earlier. No. It's not the way it works.
No, that's absolutely right. It takes a lot of work. And you do run into roadblocks. I mean, we have, public information requests that don't exactly get filled the way you think they should be fulfilled. So the other thing I want to say before, if I say nothing else about the state of journalism, is in my 40 years experience, 41, actually it's more than that. I don't know how, it's like 1975 was my first job in journalism. So it's more than that. Everything else that's available with technology and data that's now stored online and available, and everybody's got a COVID data page up, which is good because you can really see. But at the end of the day, there's nothing replaces a human source. And that's the other lost art.
And I think of the really good reporters, and I won't start naming them because I would leave someone out. But I'll pick on Jane Miller again. By the time Jane Miller called, I'll be third person. I hate it when people speak. But by the time Jane Miller called Don Moeller, she had spoken to 10 other people.
Correct. Don't ask a question to which you don't know the answer.
I was going to say, it did not take me very long to understand that when Jane said, "Can you tell me if such and such met with such and such?"
She knew the answer.
It was pretty clear to me that Jane wasn't just, hey, I think I'm going to ask.
That's right. We already knew. That's right.
So yeah, match, and that's what you're alluding to with your human sources.
Absolutely. There's no question. There's no replacement for human.
Well, that
sources.
Goes back to trust. You know, like yes, right off the correct. Bat, you only have sources you can trust.
Correct.
And we've both been at this a long time. I've had a lot of coaches try to lie to me. A lot of, you know, it's kind of like is your child lying to you or telling you the truth? If the kid's always honest, then they're
right.
always honest,
correct.
Right?
Right.
Well, Jane, because you are very busy, and again, we promise we will have you back. We've got a few more minutes here. Again, we're with WBAL investigative reporter Jane Miller. I want you to talk about Baltimore, and I'm going to preface it this mm-hmm. way. It's Baltimore positive. So I want to figure out, and we said to City Council President Scott a few minutes ago, what gives you hope? What makes you think we can get this thing turned around? And I preface it by something that's awful. And boy, did you report on it. Nestor and I have done more than one show where we've discussed the Gun Trace Task Force. And mm-hmm. we just interviewed the two reporters who wrote I Got a Monster. Mm-hmm. And literally, my wife got halfway through that show, Jane, and said, I'm done. I mean, her head was exploding. I mean, you can't. I had someone else the other day, not my wife, say to me, I got to tell you, I had to turn it off. I found it so depressing. So I want you to talk about the Gun Trace Task Force and that madness. But then I want you to talk about Jane Miller's Baltimore.
Well, I mean, the Gun Trace Task Force, you know, was like watching Training Day, I guess. You know, I mean, people were fascinated. But the truth is, the conduct that was exposed through that particular case was not new. It was not something that had not happened before. It probably didn't happen at the scale of that. But again, this was, if you remember how this case started, it started with a federal wiretap investigation of a drug organization. And, you know, if there's a hero in that whole case, it's whoever was listening to the wiretap that said, that sounds like a cop or whatever. And then off they went from there. And look, then they did a lot of work. Those investigators did a lot of work. And
it goes back to the investigators having to be honest too, right? We
yes,
have to trust
correct.
That part of it.
That's right. That's correct. But the point shouldn't be that just that case as it pertains to policing. The point should be the culture of an institution. And the unfortunate part of this to me is that in the communities that are most policed in the city of Baltimore, the police department may be the only institutional authority present. And so this is much larger than, you know, 8, 10, 12 bad cops and corrupt cops. It's much larger than the acts of the corruption. A city like Baltimore over time created this institution called the Baltimore Police Department that, first of all, takes the lion's share of general fund money, and increasingly so. If you look at, you know, city's commitment to education, recreation, health, all these, police department ever increasing. And so when you talk about how did the Gun Trace Task Force happen? Easy. I mean, these folks were given carte blanche to get guns off the street. And so I think we get lost in it's unfortunate if we spend our time talking about the Gun Trace Task Force in the specific acts of, you know, a dozen corrupt cops, as opposed to talking about what an institution like that should be. And what do we want this agency and this entity of municipal service to be? And what I mean by that is the reason the Gun Trace Task Force did what they did is because the largest single number of arrests that the Baltimore Police Department has made for the past 40 years are drug arrests. And when that's your business of going after small, large, medium size, whatever, people slinging drugs on the street, then you're going to have this interaction going on all the time. And you've got, you know, in this case, you had these officers that knew that there were certain people that had a lot of money on them. Obviously. I mean, one of the witnesses in the Grand Taste Task Force case had, you know, must have had three. I guess he said he had $300,000 in his house in the freezer or the whatever, cooler, whatever, because they took 200 or 100 or whatever. It's like, who keeps 10 keys of heroin at home? Right. I mean, right. Really, you know?
Yeah, not folks that you and I know down the street,
right.
I don't think.
Right, but my
point
is,
if you're a cop making $80,000 a year and you can score $500,000,
like,
right?
No,
and
get who away cares? With it. That's right. Nobody cares, right? That's right. So it's not just this case. And there's, yes, books are written and whatever. That's fine. But the harder question and the harder representation of that case that needs to be the not, and we aren't talking here about defunding the police. That's not going to happen. And what we do need, though, is a debate about what that institution needs to be. And are we having it be things that we shouldn't be doing anymore, such as, you know, arresting everybody on a corner with some kind of drug possession or whatever. And I hope that we get to that. I'm concerned that we can't get to that. You know, you look at what happened in, you know, Wisconsin now, and there's a lot of unrest there. This is true in every community where there's relationship between, you know, police and community members. You know, we've had it in Baltimore, and it's happened elsewhere. But to me, that's the real debate that has to occur. Is we spend, you know, $550 million on this agency, and what is it that we want this agency to be?
Jane, that is the $50 million question. You mentioned the recent incident in Wisconsin, and I've looked at, and it's going to evolve. I mean, as a reporter, you know, the initial facts are chaotic and mm-hmm. things always change. I mean, I remember always saying to the media when I'd come out, particularly amidst a shooting, say, folks, I remember clearly the day of the Perry Hall shooting. And I can remember saying to, you know, there were 20 reporters, including CNN, MSNBC, you know, everyone was there. And I can remember saying, just understand, these are the facts as we know them. They're going to change. In fact, the facts are evolving. But you touch on a piece. And again, I was someone who, at the end of my career as county executive, was in charge of 2,000 police officers, men and women, mm-hmm. sure. outstanding men and mm-hmm. women, most of whom chose to serve because they wanted to make a difference. Good men and women. I have relatives who have been and are in public safety. But boy, you touch on the question where my faith gets tested, Jane, is when I look at what I see in that Wisconsin video so far is just it looks to be an unarmed man. It may change, mm-hmm. but he looks to be unarmed, getting in his car in front of his children, and he appears to be shot 7 times. You allude to the bigger issues in the Gun Trace Task Force. I think that's what you're talking about, right? The culture?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I think what I expect that we're going to hear in that case is that those officers thought he was reaching in his car to get something, probably, you know. And there is such a gulf between some communities and the entity that polices them. It's just a really wide gulf, and it's gotten wider.
And then it gets wider with every one of these, though, right?
Exactly, it does. Well, because nothing seems to change, and I think it's bigger than this. That's what I mean, is that this requires an enormous conversation and effort and policy review to figure out how to start to close that gulf. And that, it's not happening anywhere. I mean, we're going to have these debates, you know, we're going to take a little money away from the police department. That doesn't solve this problem.
But Jane, you're a citizen. I want to come back to Jane Miller, citizen.
Mm-hmm.
More than likely, the city council president, Brandon Scott, is going to be the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming what you're describing, you would put on his plate. You know, Brandon, if you had 10 minutes with Brandon, what would you tell him? Not only, not as Jane Miller broadcaster, as Jane Miller citizen, what do you want to see from Brandon?
Well, I think that what I would hope from Brandon, and I talk to Brandon a lot. We haven't necessarily talked about it. Look, I am usually very positive in terms of Baltimore to be able to see the
That's why he brought
opportunities,
you on the show.
Et cetera, right. But I'll tell you what, I am not positive these days. I am very concerned about the economic impact of this pandemic. Look at New York. New York is, their shootings are up 84%.
Right.
They have 67,000 apartments for rent. They have a complete flight going on from parts of Manhattan to the suburbs. I would assume that we're probably seeing some of that in Baltimore, although it might be a little more subdued.
Jane, I think there's a chance. I apologize.
No, it's okay.
But you follow this. I think there's a chance that in this census, Baltimore may fall below 600,000.
It will. No, it will. It's already in the estimate. Yeah, it will be below 500,000 or 600,000.
600,000.
Yes.
Right.
And
that's mind-boggling.
Yeah, no. Well, it is. It's true of many cities actually that have been losing population. There's this. I was read a piece in a Urban Policy Institute somewhere that really since 2010 there's been this kind of movement back to the suburbs in many metropolitan areas. Baltimore is not a tech city. It's not a financial services city. So cities like Seattle, the West Coast cities, I thought New York, I don't know, we'll see with New York, they're going to recover faster. Baltimore is a healthcare city, and the healthcare has been battered by this in terms of job loss. The other thing is that really concerns me when we talk about population, we're losing our restaurant industry in not entirely, but they're really hurting. And this New York Times had a piece about this, but the same thing is true in New York. That's one of the reasons people want to live in urban areas, because you can walk to restaurants.
Correct.
You can walk to da-da-da-da-da. And you, when you start to lose that fabric, urban fabric, and it's not so important for people to necessarily live near where they work, this becomes a really serious challenge.
A
for
global
a city
challenge,
like Baltimore,
by the way, too. Not just an American challenge.
So when you ask what I would hope that both, all candidates that, you know, are looking at, you know, trying to win this election in November, have already started to put together the panel of people that are going to work on this, because there's no greater challenge. There is no greater challenge. We can talk about all the rest of it. There's no greater challenge than finding a way for this city to survive and thrive economically. And if you do that, then the public safety gets easier, et cetera. But right now, I would have been much more positive about this back before February.
Well, we're going to have you hopefully back on regularly, Jane, because you're such an important voice, and we'll certainly take note after the election and see what's happening. But before we let you get away, anyone who's listened to us on Baltimore Positive knows our love and affection for an organization called Thread and its leader, Sarah Heminger. We find them transformational. And again, we always say to folks, if you want to feel good about an organization, go out, check out thread.org, see what they're doing, think about getting involved. And I want you to talk about, because you've talked to me before when we've chatted or run into one another, about your real personal passion now with mentoring. And we want to give you a chance to sort of tell our listeners about what you're involved in mentoring.
Well, I've been very fortunate to have a guy that's been part of my life for 10 years, almost 11. And he's now in his late 20s and doing really well. And we have done made real investments in means for keeping him, first of all, for stability of housing, which is very important. So we're trying to accomplish two things. We're trying to accomplish stability of housing and also to figure out a way for him to begin to grow an asset base. And so this has to be done in a way, obviously, that is outside the traditional banking systems and everything else, because, you know, we financed a car. Why? Because the 22% is the interest rate for someone who has bad credit. Now, come on.
Right.
That's criminal. So when I talk about mentoring and extreme mentoring, what I mean is there are many people in this region that have the means to really support, and I mean support, the efforts of young people to realize independence and sustainability. And if that means fashioning a way that you can loan money at a really affordable way, or, you know, I'm not talking here about handouts at all. I'm talking about getting involved in young people's lives in a way that they have access to capital and to financing affordably.
You talk about a car. We talk so much about transportation here. Just, you know.
Can't rely on the public transportation system.
No car, no job, right?
Jane, remember, Nestor, I don't know if you saw it. Of course, I was county executive at the time. Paid careful attention to it, Jane. That's what I said. There's so much to talk about with you. Talk about when you tried to get to Trade Point. You remember, didn't you do the story? On the bus?
Actually, I went to Amazon. But
Amazon,
that's on the way.
Okay, yeah, right. Trade Point Atlanta, Amazon.
At the old GM site.
Yeah.
It was like, I got on the bus at 5:25 in the morning. I got there at 7:05 in the morning. So, and I was going from West Baltimore. It was about an 18-minute car ride. And along the way, I learned a lot of things about people who take the bus and why they take the bus. I also learned that Amazon sends a shuttle to the Charles Center Metro stop in Baltimore City to pick up its full-time employees so they get to work on time. A shuttle. Yeah, think about that. They can't rely on the public transit system to get their workers that full-time shift that starts, you know, at 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever to get there on time. So yeah, so the public transit system is it works for some. It's not an option. And especially when most of your jobs are opposite the transit lines.
Well, Jane, again, we try not to make this show all about Donald
Trump. The bad?
Not all about Donald Trump. But when you talk about housing and the need for affordable housing, we know how impossible housing is for so many who are on the edges of our society.
Correct.
And these are his words, not mine, that I want your reaction to when a president says, we have to do more to, quote unquote, keep them, there's no other way to describe it, out of your stuff. In other words, he's speaking to Don Mohler and Don Mohler's friend. We're going to keep them out of Catonsville. Mm-hmm. I mean, react to that, Jane.
Well, I mean, this is the racism that is now so, it's become part of our norm. I mean, it's always been part of our norm, but it's now really part of our norm. And it's now influencing language and rhetoric. And
yeah, we've all learned a lot about all of our friends, haven't we, in the last four years?
That's
right?
Correct. Literally. In ways that it was pretty hidden before. But I mean, yeah, this sets us back, you know, a lot when you have a president leading that kind of rhetoric and that kind of policy for the most part. It's interesting too, because he's, you know, he makes these statements about trying to reach the Black community and then turns around and makes a statement like that, which is obviously complete odds with
any
kind of effort.
And then doubles down on it. I mean, as we record this, we're in the middle of the Republican convention. And clearly if we thought that they were going to reach across the aisle and try to broaden the base, that's not what we're seeing. So, Nestor, I know Jane has to run.
Yeah, I got two questions for Jane before we go. First things first, and don't lie to me, because you're an honest person. Were you ever going to run for mayor? Like, someone told me you were thinking about running for mayor.
People contacted me about it. Yes, they did. I entertained it. Yes, I did. I mean, people contacted me.
Why would you? Why wouldn't you? Very quickly. I'll ask you this again later.
At the point, when
I would have had to
do
this, I wasn't. You might be able to win.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I wasn't thought about that. At the point of, I wasn't ready to do that at that point. And you really have to be ready to do that. At, you know, this was sometime in 2019. I think we had these conversations, and you really, you have to be absolutely invested that this is absolutely what you want to do. And especially now, I mean, my God, this is going to be a real challenge. So yes, yeah, so people had talked to me about it and I did think about it.
That's all the more reason why we thought you were going to do it, because we needed a hill charger. You know what I mean? We got Brandon.
Yeah, I know.
And were you at Penn State when Capiletti played there or not?
Yes. John and I were good buds in college.
I didn't know that. See, I knew if I asked that kind of question, I'd get something like that out of you.
You're making connections.
His fraternity and my sorority did a lot of things together, and John's a really good guy. Really.
Jane, how are you going to survive? I'm going to ask you, what does Jane Miller do to kick back? I know you love golf, and I see you all the time at the Ravens games. How are you going to survive without any home games?
You know, it's really isolating for people, too. Yeah, I'm very lucky because we do. We play golf. We have lots of things we do. We own horses. There are lots of options. We have two dogs that are remarkably quiet when I do these kinds of things. You haven't heard them yet, and they're hound dogs. They can really make a racket.
I want to hear that now.
No, they really like it. They're like movie dogs in that regard, you know. But I'm concerned about people who don't have all these kinds of ways to, you know, it's hard. It's like life right now is very isolating and it's confining. And that's really difficult for people. That's, I think, what just, if anything makes me mad, angry of the past 8 months, it's that it didn't, my opinion, based on everything I know and have covered and talked to people, it didn't have to be this way. That it had, we had a much more robust response to this pandemic from the jump back in March and taken some of the steps we're taking now, which really seem to be finally working to tamp it down. We wouldn't have gotten to this point. I'm really concerned about the loss of an economy for people that that need jobs and how to replace that.
One final point on that, Nestor, and I'll throw it to you to take us out of here. My sister is a mental health specialist in Jacksonville, Florida, and I spoke to her in the past few days, and she is gravely concerned about people's mental health, both on the domestic abuse side, on the suicide side, on the isolation side.
This isn't normal for humans. This isn't wired this way.
Gravely, gravely concerned. So before Nestor takes us out of here, Jan, I just want to say thank you and good luck and hit them straight out there.
There you go. You do. All right.
Jane Miller, I'm still going to get a crab cake with you or some shrimp and grits or some waffles and chicken over at the State Fair. Big thanks to our friends at Fadley's and at State Fair. And, of course, Moeller and Gary Realty. Houses are selling quickly out there. And our friends at the Harka Ice Cream. I'm going to hold up the Caramel Crunch because I know that's going to make Moeller want to run to the freezer and get him fat here this summer. Salted caramel ice cream with the chocolate-covered honeycomb toffee. Feels good. It's to Harka. It's made here in Baltimore. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are merging WNST.net AM 1570 and Baltimore Positive and having great guests like Jane Miller and Brandon Scott. And at some point, Larry Hogan will get back to me. Kiefer Mitchell told me so. So there it is.
We are
WNST.net AM 1570. Calm, local, live and late breaking with Jane Miller. We are Baltimore Positive.